This is Audible.
Hi, I'm Stephen Colbert, and I am no fan of books. Chances are, if you're listening to this, you and I share a healthy skepticism about the printed word. Well, I want you to know this is the first book I've ever written, and I hope it's the first book you've ever read. Don't make a habit of it. Now, you might ask yourself, if by yourself you mean me, Stephen, if you don't like books, why'd you write one? Well, you just ask yourself a trick question. I didn't write it. I dictated it. I shouted it into a tape recorder over the Columbus Day weekend, then handed it to my agent and said, sell this. He's the one who turned it into a book. It's his funeral. But I get your drift. Why even dictate? Well, like a lot of other dictators, there's one man's opinion I value above all others. Mine. And folks, I have a lot of opinions. I'm like Lucy trying to keep up with the candy at the chocolate factory. I can barely put them in my mouth fast enough. In fact, I have so many opinions, I have overwhelmed my ability to document myself. I thought my nightly broadcast, The Colbert Report, check your local listings, would pick up some of the slack. But here's the dirty little secret. When the cameras go off, I'm still talking. And right now, all that opinion is going to waste, like seed on barren ground. Well, no more. It's time to impregnate this country with my mind.
Hachette Audio presents I Am America, and So Can You, written by Stephen Colbert, read by Stephen Colbert and a full cast.
At one time, America was pure. Men were men, women were women, and gays were confirmed bachelors. But somewhere around the late 60s, it became groovy to let it all hang out while you kept on trucking, stopping only to give a hoot. And today, Lady Liberty is under attack from the cable channels, the internet blogs, and the Hollywood celebritocracy out there spewing facts like so many locusts descending on America's crop of ripe, tender values. And as any farmer or biblical scholar will tell you, locusts are damn hard to get rid of. I said on the very first episode of The Colbert Report that together I was going to change the world. And I've kept up my end of the bargain. But it's not changing fast enough. Last time I checked, my supermarket still sold yogurt from France. See a pattern? Turns out it takes more than 30 minutes a night to fix everything that's destroying America. And that's where this audiobook comes in. It's not just some collection of reasoned arguments supported by facts. No, that's the coward's way out. This audiobook is truth. My truth. I deliver my truth hot and hard, fast and furious. So either accept it without hesitation or get out of the way. Because somebody might get hurt and it's not going to be me. Think you can handle it? I'm scared of Koreans. Bam! That's me off the cuff, blunt and in your face. No editing. I think it. I say it. You hear it. Sometimes I don't even think it. I just say it. Baby carrots are trying to turn me gay. See, I'm not pulling any punches. I'm telling it like it is. Get used to it or turn this audiobook off. Because this audiobook is for America's heroes. And who are the heroes? The people who bought this audiobook. That bears repeating. People who borrow this audiobook are not the heroes. They are no better than welfare queens mooching off the system like card-carrying library card carriers. For the record, we're not offering this audiobook to libraries. No free rides. Okay, now it's my turn to ask a question. What do I want from you? Good question. Just because I haven't put a lot of thought into this audiobook doesn't mean you shouldn't. I want you to listen to this audiobook carefully. Savor my ideas. Memorize pertinent passages. Eat with it. Sleep with it. Let nature take its course. Because what I have dictated here is nothing less than a constitution for the Colbert Nation. And like our founding fathers, I hold my truths to be self-evident, which is why I did absolutely no research. I didn't need to. The only research I needed was a long, hard look in the mirror. For this audiobook is my story. And as such, it is the American story. You know, I'm reminded of the words of Walt Whitman, the 19th century poet, naturalist, and all-around man's man, who through his epic lyricism defined the character of this new nation. He said, I celebrate myself and sing myself, and what I assume, you shall assume. That I he was talking about? It's me. Bottom line, listen to this book. Be me. I am America. And so can you. My American childhood. My earliest memory is from when I was 3 years old. My mother came into my room. I can still smell the perfume she was wearing, which I assume they don't make anymore because I spent a lot of time at department stores looking for it. She swooped me up and she told me that she and my father were leaving me. Then she carried me to the living room to meet Ruth. I was not entirely clear on what a babysitter was, so naturally I assumed this old woman was going to replace my parents forever. Well, I was not on board with this plan. I may have only been 3 years old, but I already knew that a family was a mother, a father, the kids, and the pets. There was no room in that model for some ancient crone wearing slacks, and, in my opinion, too many rings. The minute my parents left, I ordered my stuffed animals to attack. No response. So I threw them down the laundry chute and tried my luck with a real animal, our cat, Cleopatra. I carried her to my emergency bunker, the linen closet behind the vacuum cleaner. From there, we could lead the resistance against this new Ruth regime. That's where the enemy struck. Ruth was making fish sticks. I held Cleopatra close, but she scratched my face and dashed for the kitchen. Desperate, I started praying, mostly to God, although it's possible a prayer to Santa might have snuck in there someplace. I prayed he would bring my parents home and make our family whole again. And when I woke up in the morning, not only had God gotten rid of Ruth and brought back my parents, he had also moved me from the linen closet to my own bed. Now that's service. Why do I share this memory? Because it perfectly captures the five F's of childhood. Family, faith, furry friends, and fear of the elderly. These are the fundamental relationships that teach us where we belong, what belongs to us, and who we belong to. My second memory is when we went to the zoo and I saw two rhinos do it. Chapter 1, The Family. Folks, we're at war. I'm not talking about the war in Iraq or the war in Afghanistan or the war on drugs. I'm talking about a war with a higher stakes than all those other wars combined and then divided by three. Battleground I'm talking about? The American family. Think of America as a body, but not in the obvious way where Lake Michigan is the eye and Maine is the upturned nose and Texas is the Adam's apple and Florida is a really pointy beard. No, let's look deeper. Let's look at the biological building block of America, the family. Now, what's a family? Well, according to the U.S. Census Bureau, a family is defined as two or more people living together who are related by birth, marriage, or adoption. In other words, the U.S. Census Bureau is run by radical leftists. Why do you think there's a whole category for the unemployed? If you ask me, and you did, from time immemorial, the word family has meant only one thing. A mom married to a pop, raising 2.3 rambunctious little scamps. That's what's called the nuclear family. Now, I got that name because it reached its peak during the early years of the Cold War, when Americans were in immediate danger of nuclear annihilation. Back then, family members knew their roles, and nobody questioned parental authority. After all, Dad was the one with the keys to the fallout shelter. What makes the nuclear family so special? Well, just like a real nuclear isotope, it's incredibly stable. Plus, it's a convenient shorthand for referring to a group of individuals. Think how much time it would take if we had to name each individual instead of simply saying the Johnsons. Okay? That's time we should be spending with our families. That sounds wonderful, you say. But how do you create a nuclear family of your own? Well, it starts with a simple formula. Man plus woman equals marriage. End of story. Now, once you've locked up a spouse of the appropriate opposite sex, it's time to get to know one another in the biblical sense by studying the Bible together. In it, you'll find the function of marriage is to provide men and women a safe, God-approved context for their wildest sexual romps, the sole purpose of which is to produce children. So get on it. I'll wait. So now what? Now that you've produced children, it's your job to socialize them. That means you've got a role to play, folks, a role you audition for in the sack. The minute that baby pops out, you've got the part. And if you play it right, just like De Niro, you're going to gain a lot of weight. The father. America used to live by the motto, father knows best. Now we're lucky if father knows he has children. We've become a nation of sperm donors and baby daddies. But there's more to being a father than taking the kids to Chuck E. Cheese and supplying the occasional Y chromosome. Father has to be a provider, a teacher, a role model, but most importantly, a distant authority figure who can never be pleased. Otherwise, how will children ever understand the concept of God? Every organization needs strong leadership, and at home, my word is law. What I say goes. For instance, recently my son wanted a laptop computer for his birthday. I said, go ask your mother. And he did. Okay, that's called respect. Now, with great power comes great responsibility. That's why a father should always wear a collared shirt and carry a tire gauge. You never know when a few pounds of air pressure will mean the difference between life and death for you and your family. Fathers should also work. A lot. Anything less than 100 hours a week and the kids are going to get to know dad, and like the old saying goes, familiarity breeds contempt. And sure, it's nice to have a second income to buy the little extras like vacations or a place to live, but the mother should never be the primary wage earner. Kids see that, they lose respect for their father and decide to become gay. Every time. It's known as teenage rebellion, and I've seen parades full of it. Now, one of Pop's most important jobs is protecting his little family. That's why he needs to sleep with a 9mm under his pillow and pack it with hollow point bullets. At the least sign of movement in his castle past 8 p.m., he should wake up firing. Let God, Allah, or Hanuman the monkey god sort him out. Am I right? Finally, and I think most importantly, Dad's got to protect the weaker minds of his wife and offspring from the burden of worry. He can't show any sign of indecision, financial trouble, or even sickness. That's why it is imperative, guys, fathers never go to the doctor. They might find out something is wrong, knowledge which you could never share. The crushing burden of stuffing emotion for decades is our nation's number one killer of dads, or it should be. So Dad's got a pretty tough job. That's why he needs to be treated right. Don't bother him when he walks in the door. Let him have that martini or leaf through the latest issue of Woodboat Enthusiast before you go running to him with your affections and or suspicions about the relationship he may or may not be having with the head of human resources. Quick note to the wives here. Never withhold sex as a weapon. It is a hungry dog that turns over the trash. All right? Think about that. The mother. Look, don't get me wrong. Being a mom is no picnic. Raising the kids is the mother's responsibility. It's a thankless, solitary job like sheriff or the pope. The mother-child bond is a fragile thing. That's why I didn't let my mom out of my sight until 2 years after I was married. But while time apart is hard on the kids, it's devastating for mom. There's something I call the maternal instinct. It's a natural part of every female from the paramecium all the way up to the female human woman. Females need to nurture constantly. So they hate any time alone where they're left to think or shower or sleep. For mom to be happy, I mean really happy, every moment away from her children must be filled with the soul-wrenching thought, am I a bad mother? Well, the answer to that question is a resounding yes. Scientists have proven, one assumes, that every flaw in a child can be traced back to a mistake made by the mother. As adults, we're all imperfect, so that means all mothers are incompetent. But some mothers are worse than others. Take women who work. I don't care if it's a CEO of a major corporation or 3 hours a week as a teacher's aide. If you work outside the home, you might as well bring coconut arsenic squares to the school bake sale. Mother needs to be in the home even when the kids aren't. A messy house sends a coded message to children. I'm not lovable. Otherwise, mom would dust. By the way, another coded message, can't your father help you? Means feel free to take drugs. A good mother cooks, cleans, drives, organizes charity events so her children can earn community service points for college, and expects nothing in return except love and breakfast in bed one day a year. So a word to all you feminidiamines. Stop liberating moms by trying to make them join the workforce. They're already doing the job that God put them here to do. Everything. Now, it doesn't matter how my parents raised me, because I loved my parents. It's right there in the Bible. honor thy mother and thy father. It's right after the part about stoning gays. Sure, they could be a little strict, but I often think back fondly on the memories I haven't repressed. The truth is, I wouldn't be the man I am today if it wasn't for the way my parents raised me. And I love the man I am today, which means I love the way my parents raised me. Even if they made mistakes, I don't blame them for it, because they tried their hardest. Remember, you can't spell parentry without try. Also, you can't spell emotional abuse without bus, which is why I do not take public transportation. Of course, any parent will make a few mistakes. The important thing is that the mistakes you make with your kids are the same ones your parents made with you. At least you know how those turned out. So now that mom and dad know their roles, what's next? Raising a family. Child rearing is arguably the most important of my core values. I believe in it, I practice it, and I ceaselessly promote it to my friends and followers. That said, generally speaking, I'm against children. What's the matter? Did I shake you up? You see, I'm not against the conception of children, like I said. They're the only permissible reason for intercourse. And I'm not against pregnancy. In fact, if you ask me, there's nothing more beautiful than a third trimester mother-to-be in full maternity regalia. Maybe it's the elastic, I don't know. But the effect is stunning. No, my problem with children is the children themselves. They may be cute, but they are here to replace us. Make no mistake. Need proof? You ever catch one walking around in your shoes? That's a chilling moment, like finding an empty body snatcher pod in the basement. But children are our future, you say. Yes. But does that not also mean that we are their past? I don't understand why we're helping them. You don't see union factory workers throwing a benefit for robots. Now, I'm sure some of you out there are thinking, why take child-rearing advice from someone who mistrusts children? Well, the answer is simple. I respect my opponents. I urge you all to do the same. Now, I wish I could come to each of your houses to help you raise your kids. But I got my hands full with my own children, as well as several pending negligent Big Brother lawsuits. Instead, I offer these simple child-raising tips. Tip number one, set some rules. Don't worry if a rule makes sense. The important thing is that it's a rule. Arbitrary rules teach kids discipline. If every rule made sense, they wouldn't be learning respect for authority. They'd be learning logic. So go crazy with the rules. The time your child spends trying to figure them out is time he won't spend stapling firecrackers to the neighbor's dog. Here's a couple of arbitrary rules I like to throw out. Wash your hands before talking to strangers. If you look at a cat and it sneezes, no dessert for a week. Jell-O must never be jiggled. Red means stop, green means go, purple means Wednesday. I'm very firm on that one. Look, and if they ever call bullshit on your game, there's an added benefit there, too. Let me tell you a little story. Once there was a child whose father had lots of rules that the child thought were unfair. What's more, the strict father was never around, but continued making even more unreasonable demands on the child. Finally, the child had enough. He rebelled and lived happily ever after. That child's name? America. Tip number two, there can only be one. No matter how many kids you have, you need to pick a favorite. It's going to happen on its own, but it'll happen faster if you and your spouse have at least debated the issue. The important thing is not to tell any of your kids who the favorite is. Just let them know that you have one. That's a guessing game that will keep them occupied and quiet on many a road trip. Side tip, try misspelling one of their names every so often. Tip number three, they can smell fear. Never show weakness in front of your child. This means never letting them see you cry. If you must cry, run into your room, lock the door, turn on the shower, and play the stereo real loud. I recommend Billy Joel's Big Shot. And when you're done, tell your kids you were so angry you had to take a shower to cool down and then deduct the cost of the hot water from his or her allowance. Tip number four, don't cry over spilled milk. Unspill it. If you ever wanted to travel back in time to relive your childhood, now you can, by living it through your kid's childhood. Children are tiny versions of you, minus the crushing failure. If you're not going to live your unrealized dreams through your kids, when will you? Fill them with your dashed hopes and shattered dreams. If they succeed, doesn't that mean in some small way that you yourself succeeded? And if they fail, well, then your dream was probably impossible in the first place. Though your kid may want to throw his kids at it just to make sure. Tough subject. Next. divorce. Divorce is marital welfare. It's just couples asking society to bail them out because they didn't do enough research before they got married. How's that our fault? Don't drag down my country's statistics because you ran off and got hitched before you ever saw each other in a bad mood. The following are not valid reasons for divorce. You didn't realize you had to be monogamous. The time period covered by the prenup expired. Your married name is something like Anita Hardcock. Or the girl you had a crush on in high school just got divorced. You see, the problem is, folks, more and more young Americans are reaching their prime childbearing years and making statements like, "Oh, I don't believe in marriage. My parents' divorce was so terrible that I don't want to go through the same thing." Next thing you know, they're either single parents or just single, a drain on society either way. Our bad example is ruining marriage for our children. That's why, for their sake, all American couples must at least fake happiness until their children are married. If it'll help you through your misery, think of yourselves as magicians performing a deftly crafted illusion for more than 20 years. One way or another, you gotta work things out. Do not get a divorce. It's bad for society, it's in direct opposition to God's will, and it makes hard to know what people's last names are. So walk it off, work it out. 30-day return policy and then no exchanges. America has a thriving marital counseling industry for just this reason. Now it's time for Stephen Speaks for Me. This is the first of several sections in this audiobook where I give average Americans the chance to agree with what I think. First up, Dolores Grierson, Old Maid.
I shan't say I've never felt the thrilling touch of an amorous embrace, but I also shan't say it. For I was raised in a refined era when ladies did not amorously embrace and tell. For the record, it was a vigorous necking that once descended to the upper shoulder. I've said too much. Oh, I have loved. Every fortnight, I water the shriveled bouquet of roses given to me at the debutante ball by my suitor, Horace O'Connor, the man I had hoped to marry. But I was too spirited and willful, and I spurned his proposal. I wanted to wait until I was 17. 17! But I mustn't linger on memories of Horace. After he moved away, I vowed I would find a purpose for my life other than marriage and family. My search was as fruitless as my womb. On the bright side, if I had raised a family, well, who would have raised my cats? My wonderful, wonderful cats. What would have become of Tiger and Cupcake and Professor Snugglepuss? Who would put out milk for Princess Sheba and D'Artagnan the Mousketeer? Who would knit personalized collars for Footloose, Fancy Free, Mr. Whiskers, and Mrs. Chevious Whiskers? Nay, Mischievous. Old Blackie, Princess Grace Kitty, Queen Neferkitty, Old King Cat, Arsenic, Old Lace, and Adjunct Professor Mimsy. Yes, I have had a full life. Come, let me show you a page from my diary. 6:30 a.m. Overslept. Queen Neferkitty is not pleased. 6:45 a.m. Prepared breakfast of poached eggs, jam and toast, and fried sausages. 6:53 a.m. Prepared my breakfast. 7 o'clock a.m. Ate my bowl of wheatina. 7:30 to noon. Wrote and mailed letters to relatives, most of whom are deceased. Over the next few weeks, the letters will trickle back stamped, return to sender. Oh, it's so nice to get mail. Noon to 12:30. Stared. 12:30 to 1:45. Embroidered a slip for my pillow. Singular. 2 o'clock, a visit from the postman. The fall issue of Can't Fancy is here. Did you hear that, everybody? 2:15 to 7 o'clock, fancied my cats in accordance with the latest cat fancying trends. 7:30, the neighborhood children threw rocks at fearsome Grierson's door. I wanted to shout at them, "That doesn't even rhyme!" But instead, I watched silently from behind the shutters. Oh, they will get theirs. 7:40, and how? 8 o'clock to 9 o'clock p.m. Updated will. Professor Snugglepuss is in for a wonderful surprise. The other cats will just have to understand. 9 o'clock p.m. Lights out! Good night, my feline companions. Midnight. Good night, Horace.
Chapter 2. Old people. Newsflash! Do you notice how loud I'm speaking?
Well, folks, I considered shouting that loud for the entire book on tape, but that was when I thought I was getting paid by the decibel. That was a joke, in case you couldn't tell. I don't blame you if you couldn't. Can't tell if someone's making a joke if you can't see that person's face. Big reason I don't like books, no faces. Can't tell when they're being funny. Point is, I'm talking about seniors here, and old folks can't hear anything that's not shouted at them. To them, this last paragraph of sounds is like the hum of a refrigerator coil. Anyway, even though seniors can't make out most of the words that I'm speaking right now, I thank them for listening anyway.
Thank you for listening to this, seniors!
I must say, dictating a whole chapter directing at seniors is a waste of time. Can't teach an old dog new tricks. They're too tired. Plus, they're from the library card generation. They share books. They don't believe in buying multiple collector's copies, no matter what kind of rare, bizarre, coded message appears in the first edition. I mean no disrespect by this, but old people are useless to me. So this chapter is now redirected to all of you not yet seniors. Besides, since seniors can't hear this, I can say whatever I want about them. They look like lizards. See? No angry letters. By now, some of the older listeners out there are probably thinking, what's that Colbert boy going on about? Let's not forget about them.
It is the duty of all Americans to respect and cherish our elders.
Now, don't get me wrong. There are some good things about seniors. One, they are the greatest generation. No other generation in history has ever been quite so willing to be poor, fight wars, or have babies. Two, they were alive in the good old days. They're living testament to a time when America was number one, and so was butterscotch. Three, my mom is one of them. If you have a problem with old folks, you have a problem with my mom. So let me ask you, punk, do you have a problem with my mom? Because I would love to hear about it. I love you, Mom! Four, they are often forgiven for racial intolerance. Whew. Now the bad news. After criminals and babies, seniors are the most coddled segment of the population. They have everything given to them, from pensions to discount meals to help crossing the street. And despite all they get, they still complain. Another news flash. It's not the seniors' fault that they're such whiners. There's somebody else to blame. Franklin D. Roosevelt, who gave our country Social Security, a system which rewards seniors for doing nothing. Sorry, but the idea of retirement offends me. You just don't stop fighting in the middle of a war because your legs hurt. So why do you get to stop working in the middle of your life just because your prostate swells? That's desertion, which in my book gets you an early bird special at the firing squad buffet.
Our elders are a precious resource!
Like I said, ever since I was a kid, I've been baffled by retirement, pensions, and Social Security. You want proof? Look what I found in the Colbert Attic Archives. I couldn't have been more than seven when I wrote it.
Dear Grandpa, thank you for the baseball glove. I will rub it with oil and put it under my mattress until it's soft like you said. Thank you for coming to my birthday party. I like your funny jokes. I was wondering, where did you get the money to buy my gloves since you don't go to work anymore? Mom says you got it from the government and from your old job. But why do they give you money if you don't do work for them? I don't think you should get money for doing nothing. So I wrote a letter to President Nixon to tell him to stop paying all the grandpas who don't work anymore. Don't worry, you won't be poor, because you can come work for me. You can sleep on the floor next to my bed, and when I'm at school, you can do my chores. I'll give you some of my allowance, but not enough to buy baseball gloves. Love, Stephen.
Here's the point. Social Security didn't make sense to me as a seven-year-old, and it sure doesn't make sense to me now. All right, think of it this way. If an alien came down from the galaxy and told you that on his planet they have a system where all the young, hard-working aliens give up a large number of their glicksnards for the benefit of the non-working elder Vorzoths, and that by the time they were ready to become Vorzoths, the glicksnard cisterns might be dangerously depleted, you bet your sweet bippy you'd have a lot of questions. And yet our human American Vorzoths, seniors, have banded together to preserve their hoard of glicksnards, money, at the expense of the young. They call this group the AARP, or ARP, which probably stands for something, but to me, ARP sounds like the noise an old man makes when he's trying to get out of a beanbag chair. So, what do we do about these year-hoggers? Is there a solution to America's elderly crisis that doesn't involve changing our lives in any way or making us feel guilty?
Yes. Think of the money in the Social Security Trust Fund as investment capital. Right now, we're putting that money into millions of small-cap, zero-yield investments, the jazzy set. No offense, but unless Rosalyn and Benjamin Schneider of Forest Hills suddenly decide to get off their apple pancake asses and personally invade Iran, we are not getting value for our money. We need to utilize senior strengths to get a return on our investment. Are you still awake? Look, I'm not going to win any awards for saying this, but the elderly are like rude party guests. They come early, they're always in the bathroom, and now they just won't leave. I say we do the same thing to them that I do to stragglers at my shindigs, put them to work cleaning up the place. Only this time, the place is called America. First, let's use them to shut down our porous southern border. The one thing old people have a knack for is keeping kids off their lawn. I remember growing up, old man Schmidt would sit in that rocking chair of his like he was manning a guard tower at a Nazi prison camp. One misstep onto his immaculate master lawn was enough to trigger the old man's shriek of, Auf mein Gras, das ist verboten! I say, let's build a 2,000-mile-long front porch along our border with Mexico and line it with the angry aged. When the Mexicans try to cross, they'll be turned into Mexicants. When a million grandpas bellow, get off my country, I just ceded. Plus, old people are suckers for heat. Hey, anybody want a free trip to California, Arizona, New Mexico, and or Texas? Now, are they up to the job? Make no bones about it, old people are tough. Many of them grew up having to scrap for every penny. They made shoes out of newspaper and twine and subsisted on a thin stew of newspaper and twine. Sometimes they'd have to go without shoes and stew altogether so that there would be enough newspaper and twine to treat the baby's scarlet fever. I'd say they can handle Jose. Of course, the simplest answer to the problem of the aged is for people to stop getting old. There was a time I thought this was impossible, but that was before I developed my age-defying protein pudding. It is based on a high gelatin diet that has kept cow hooves supple for centuries. And now another Stephen speaks for me. Gil Honeycomb, the oldest man in the world.
Hello, I'm Gil Honeycomb. I'm the oldest man in the world. A lot of senior citizens will tell you they miss the good old days. Not me, no. I never cared for them that much. Besides, what was so good about them? Between 1918 and 1920, close to 100 million people died of Spanish flu. Whoopee! Break out the party hats. We'll put them on the corpses. Perhaps these same seniors missed the Great Depression, too. I know I have fond memories of beating a hobo for scraps of cantaloupe rind. Oh, if only that bloody bindle would fit in my scrapbook. Oh, let's not forget the joy of racism. You wouldn't believe the horrible things they called African Americans and Irish back then. I still can't eat potato salad without thinking of Eugene O'Neill. No, thank you. I much prefer the present. Things are so much better today. Take medicine. In the old days, you'd go see a doctor and he'd write you a prescription for a carton of Viceroy cigarettes. I lost my beloved Doris to appendicitis because the doctor said her T-zone wasn't getting enough smooth flavor. No, the only good thing about the past is that the Chicago Cubs would occasionally win the World Series, but that's it. Everything else was Nazis and disease. I just thank God I'm alive to see the world today, to see with my own eyes all the wonderful advances in medicine, society, and technology. I am so lucky I can enjoy all the modern world has to offer. Nothingness.
Chapter 3. Animals. Humans may be in charge of this planet, folks, but it's a precarious position. There are only 6 billion of us. And if my pest control bill is any indication, there are at least that many squirrels in my attic. I don't know how much more poison I can keep squirting up there. I'm getting woozy. It's clear that when we're outnumbered by these creatures, we gotta take a page from the British Empire and rule the lesser species through intimidation. That's why the single most important thing you can do as a human being is to dominate an animal. Need more proof? Just look at Genesis. Rule over the fish of the sea and the birds of the air and over every other living creature that moves on the ground. I'd say God about covered it. Because if we didn't dominate these animals, you better believe they'd be dominating us. And that is a scenario so horrific, not even Hollywood could produce it. But here's my pitch, just in case they want to. What if liberals won, and we surrendered to our four-legged friends? It's just like the Planet of the Apes, only this time, the planet is Earth. Where? The united nests, burrows, dens, and hives of America. When? The near future. That's trademarked.
All hail President Three-Toed Sloth.
Can't wait to see if he follows through on his campaign promise to eat leaves and bask in the sun. If he doesn't, don't blame me. I voted for Senator Box Turtle. Slow and steady lost this race. Our hero, Stephen, the last human male, has woken up to a nightmarish breakfast of ham and eggs. Only the ham is his wife, Petunia the pig, and the eggs are his sons, Foghorn and Leghorn. Thanks to the liberals, interspecies marriage is now the norm. The school may not be teaching Spanish, but now the kids are forced to learn sheepish. You see, Stevens lost his job to a Canadian chinstrap goose because illegal migratory birds keep pouring into the country and the liberals won't put up a border net. Get his job back. Stephen fights a legal battle all the way up to the activist rabbit judges on the Supreme Hutch, only to be defeated by some East Coast ivy-eating sheep with a woolier-than-thou attitude. The ruling is reported on Fox News by an actual fox. I'm going to let that sink in. Now, when all seems lost, Stephen meets the last human female, and together they rediscover the majestic beauty and healing power of the missionary position. This would be handled very tastefully. The end? For the record, it wouldn't have to be the end, in case you wanted to do a sequel. I'm open to that. The little nightmare I just described, and registered with the Writers Guild, is why I strongly recommend getting a pet, any pet, and then dominating it. It's the best way to remind the animal kingdom who's the boss. Plus, nothing is more satisfying than subjugating a lower creature to your will. When I tell my dog Gipper to fetch my slippers, I feel a sense of rightful empowerment, placing myself at the apex of nature's org chart. Of course, Gipper has very sensitive legs, so when I ask him to fetch me something, I have to physically carry him over to that spot and pick up the item myself. But believe me, he gets the idea. For a human, dominating an animal should be as natural as smoking a turkey. And yet, it's a joy many adults no longer experience. And you know why? Because from the time you're a kid, the media is feeding you lies to put the power structure out of whack. So before you become a pet owner, here are a few things you need to understand in order to put the power structure in of whack. Now, some would have our children believe that animals are all cute and cuddly. It starts the day we bring baby Kyle or Callie or Kayla or Caitlin or Kelsey home from the hospital to a room wallpapered in adorable little yellow ducks. Why aren't these ducks being pursued by adorable little yellow hunters? I don't know, but I'm willing to bet it has something to do with the far-left media's control of the wallpaper industry. Yes, I consider the wallpaper industry part of the media. It has the word paper in it. What's the very first book most children own? A bit of blatant propaganda called Pat the Bunny. Now, I'm not saying Pat the Bunny isn't a good book. There's that soft patch of fur on page one for you to pat. Then there's the smooth part and the scratchy part. And don't get me started on the mirror. There's so much to do, and you don't even need to know how to read. It's the perfect book. But a pro-bunny manifesto with that kind of sensory stimulation, what chance do our children have? Hey, kids, are you listening? Quick side note. All dogs go to heaven? No. Sorry, kids. It's only dogs who've accepted Christ. Then, of course, we got the nursery rhymes. What's a cuter image than three little kittens that have lost their mittens? Well, brace yourself. Kittens don't wear mittens. I'm going to let that sink in. And why don't they wear mittens? Because they just get caught on their razor-sharp claws. Personally, I prefer three blind mice because, one, they're already handicapped when the song starts, as a result, no doubt, of some anti-human scheme that blew up in their faces, and two, they're further maimed in the course of the rhyme. The list is endless. Cartoon characters, dogs, cats, rabbits, ducks, horses, squirrels, gorillas, all of them talking, all of them so very human. Of course, the most famous offender is Bambi, which, for reasons that escape me, portrays the death of a deer negatively. You can bet you'll never see an animated classic about what Bambi's mom devoured for her last meal. My defenseless oakleaf hydrangea. My point is this. If America is ever to stop kowtowing to the animal petters, we have to get to our youth before they do. Children have to learn that these animals aren't our buddies. And sometimes it's a tough lesson. But what about me, you ask? When I was a kid, I had a dog named Shasta. We were inseparable. We'd play in the backyard, maybe chase a ball, just go splashing around the old creek. Shasta was my best friend. Then after 14 happy years together, I came home one day from school and Shasta didn't greet me at the door. My mom and dad sat me down and told me the terrible news. Shasta had gone to live on a big, beautiful farm upstate. I couldn't believe it. I never felt so betrayed in my life. I thought Shasta and I were a team, but as soon as some smooth-talking stranger came along with a promise of a bigger field, she was gone. Sorry I wasn't a farmer, Shasta. The suburb had zoning laws. We couldn't just grow crops in the yard. How could you? I pressed my parents for answers, but my mom wouldn't stop crying, and my dad just kept saying she was chasing rabbits. Chasing rabbits? I guess Shasta was lying to me about that degenerative hip disease, too. So wake up, America. Pets don't care about you. They're just using you for food and for the social networking you can provide when you walk them. But the joke's on you, Shasta. If you're listening to this, you should know that I have a new dog, Gipper. And Gipper is twice the dog you'll ever be. His coat is way shinier than yours, and he doesn't chew up my comic books. And he hates farms. Gipper will never betray me, and he's never going to leave me. He's been right by my side for the last 15 years, and he'll be there for the next 50. Sorry, I didn't realize how fresh those memories were. Okay, now that I've pulled the wool off your eyes about animals, you're ready to get one and establish the proper dominant relationship. It's important to select the right animal. Different lifestyles call for different pets to master. If you're away from your home a lot, you may want to boss around a cat. If you don't like to exercise, consider lording over an iguana or maybe a weak-willed parakeet. But if you do have time to dedicate, there is no beast more satisfying to dominate than the dog. And once you've selected a pet and named it, it's time to bend the animal to your will. I've done this with my dog, Gipper, by teaching him a few authoritative commands, such as sit. When I order Gipper to sit, I'm letting him know that I am his superior. Of course, Gipper has a bad back, so after I ask him to sit, I massage his hindquarters while I ease him onto a pillow. Just like humans, dogs determine what type of person you are by the firmness of your handshake. If you have a strong grip, they'll respect you. If you have a weak grip, they'll turn your neck into a chew toy. So be sure to give your dog's paw a hearty squeeze and never break eye contact. Of course, my dog Gipper doesn't like to be touched, so when I ask him to shake, I bow to him Japanese style while averting my gaze. Side note, I went to the zoo once. Not impressed. The animals were lazy. If I want to see a monkey sleeping, I'll tranquilize one. I mean, if I went to a play and all the actors were asleep, I'd get a refund. But what do you expect from today's modern zoos? Now every animal has its own habitat. Bear country, tiger mountain, hedgehog hotel, baboon condo. It's all so safe and sterile. How are my kids supposed to learn anything about nature if the animals aren't savaging one another? I say we put all the animals into one big enclosure and let them battle it out. After all, it's a dog-eat-dog world. So let's have some dogs eating each other. Now my dog Gipper, though, he has a very sensitive stomach. I just boil chicken breast and chop it into some basmati rice. And now, someone else who agrees with what I think. Cow number L73NR. A cow.
I'd like to thank Stephen for the opportunity to put my two cents in here. To be honest, I was hesitant to commit my thoughts to this audiobook. The last thing I want to do is perpetuate the illusion that I actually have thoughts. Dinner doesn't think, and you shouldn't think about your dinner. Hey, want to hear a funny joke? Cattle prods. Guess you had to be there. It's just that I don't understand why, after offering me the opportunity to be processed into sirloin, Farmer Joe thinks he needs to twist my hoof. I'm in. What's that, honey? In a minute, Mommy's recording something for an audio book. That's right. B-O-O-K. Book. Good girl. Now run along and tell your sister it's time for bed. Calves. You know, Mahatma Gandhi once said, the cow is a poem of compassion. But you know what I say? The cow's a rack of short ribs. Speaking of Gandhi, it's at times like these, approaching the mechanical separators, that I'm glad I'm a Hindu. Because I know I've lived a good life and will come back again and again until I escape the wheel of samsara. When I next return, I hope I'm a human. First thing I'm going to do is have a steak. I'm dying to know what all the fuss is about. You people sure seem eager to get it off my bones. Well, I should sign off before I get to the captive bolt stunner. Enjoy me.
Chapter 4. Religion. We've got some bad news for the godless. Religion is inescapable. There's never been a human society without some form of worship. And don't point to communist societies like the Soviet Union. They worship blue jeans. Of course, beatniks, peaceniks, and no goodniks question why we need religion. Imagine they croon, there's no countries. It isn't hard, it's true. Nothing to fight or kill for, and no religion, too. You may find that idea appealing because it rhymes. But so does this. God said to Noah, there's going to be a floody floody. Get those children out of the muddy muddy. Mine rhymes four times. The children mentioned in that Bible verse didn't think they needed religion either. And look what happened to them. Drowny, drowny. Bottom line, religion is the cornerstone of civilization. Without it, there would be no laws, no morality, no social structure, and no guidelines for furnishing our tabernacles. We would exist in a state of valueless depravity like they do in Holland. If you're listening to this in Dutch, please change the name Holland to Belgium. Here's the good news. Religion exists. So mankind can benefit from its numerous gifts. Among them, law. The Ten Commandments are the basis of our entire system of justice. Without them, we wouldn't have laws, and without laws, there'd be chaos. Those two tablets give you everything you need to run an orderly society. Lying, stealing, murdering, adultery, idol worship, and coveting are out. Parent honoring and Sabbath observance are in. By the way, if you're listening to this on your religion's Sabbath, you better have a non-believer there pressing play and stop for you. Because when it comes to the TCs, I'm an originalist. That means if a neighbor takes so much as a covetous glimpse at my wife, I'm looking for my lucky stoning hat. Religion lays out clear definitions of good and evil, distinguishing good deeds, or solids in biblical Hebrew, from sins. Think about it. Without this guidance and reward punishment system, how would we know that it's actually good to give charity to beggars? Plus, without the concept of right and wrong, we'd have no cowboy movies or cop shows, because there'd be no good guys and bad guys. Just guys. And folks, forget about karaoke. I mean, if loving you is wrong, I don't want to be right is my go-to crowd pleaser. But who wants to hear, if loving you is okay, then okay? Religion gives communities reasons to come together and build bonds through shared participation in rituals. Admit it. People would never speak to anyone outside their immediate families if not for mandatory pilgrimages to holy rocks or watching virgins' hearts get carved out atop their ziggurats. I believe it was the tiger philosopher Hobbes who described human life as solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and short. Religion allows us to ignore all that by praying. When we appeal to our deities with a slaughtered ewe or prostration, or in the case of Hare Krishna's, an airport conga line, we exert some control over our existence and are filled with hope that God may improve it. Otherwise, we'd just be chanting our deepest desires into a silent, indifferent void. How depressing would that be? Folks, life is chaotic and unpredictable. If a butterfly flaps its wings in the Amazon, it could cause people at the other end of the globe to watch a Discovery Channel special on butterflies. And what's on next? A show about tornadoes. Who made such a harrowing program schedule full of such seemingly random destruction? It was God's will. Religion forces every individual to take responsibility, specifically, take it away from yourself and give it to God. If we had to be accountable for every one of our actions, we'd be crippled with indecision. But with religion pointing the way, we can feel confident in our choice to picket our children's elementary school when we find out the art teacher is gay. By the way, quick hello to Mr. Jelinek. In my religion, if you're good, you don't die. It's my favorite gift of religion because it's the most practical. Here's an example. I got that CBS Civil War series on DVDs last Christmas, but I haven't had time to watch it. But thanks to my religion, after I depart my earthly body, I'll have eternity to watch those DVDs with Abraham Lincoln. Okay, he can tell me if Ken Burns got it right. So now that you understand religion's gifts, you can understand why America chose to be a godly nation. And by godly, I mean Jesusly. Make no mistake, America is a Christian nation. The bedrock of our theodemocracy is our Judeo-Christian values. That term, by the way, is a bit of a misnomer. It implies that Christianity and Judaism are equal, which makes about as much sense as comparing Jesus to Moses. One of them could walk on water, the other one had to part it. Which one seems more Christian to you? Think of Judeo-Christian like Sears, Roebuck, and Company. Judaism is Roebuck. Now, the secular progressives out there are going to say, hold on, Colbert. Wasn't America founded on the ideas of Enlightenment thinkers like Hume and Paine? Common misconception. Who landed at Plymouth Rock? Pilgrims. And the only reason they got on the Mayflower was to flee religious persecution. That means they had a religion, Christianity. And thank God they did. If it wasn't for Jesus' message of love in their hearts, do you think they would have taught the Indians that maize is really called corn? Now, since the pilgrims were victims of persecution, some assumed that they were tolerant. Well, that's just liberal propaganda. Sure, they were against persecution of pilgrims. But after they changed their name to Puritans in what I believe was a copyright dispute, they were more than happy to drown what lesbians now call Wiccans. We hear a lot about how the founders created a so-called wall of separation between church and state. Well, the myth of such a wall was exacerbated by our Constitution's confusingly worded First Amendment. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion. Many point to these words as somehow prohibiting the establishment of Christianity as our national religion. But if the founders were so anti-Christian, how come the Constitution never mentions evolution? Checkmate. And even if I'm wrong, just because Congress shall make no law doesn't mean that we can't establish a religion. It just means we'll have to do it without Congress. An executive order, perhaps? So, to sum up, America is a Christian nation, and as the old Negro spiritual says, this train is bound for glory, this train. Folks, America is riding the Jesus train. Attention travelers, please note that the Jesus train is not the crazy train, or the night train, or the midnight train to Georgia. There's a big difference. Check your tickets before boarding. No refunds. And if you want to go first class on Christ's track, there is only one way to ride. Roman Catholicism. Jesus founded only one church, and folks, it wasn't Unitarian. He took his apostle Simon, and he turned him into a rock, and he built a church on him. It's called the Holy Roman Catholic and Apostolic Church, or Church for short. Now, Catholics have some advantages.